Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 4:20 p.m. and that is Eastern Summer Time. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I would kick off today by looking at some of the barometers that Jim O'Neill has said that point towards recessions. Certainly, there were a lot of fears about a recession last year, and Jim O'Neill, who's was one of the people that was credited with creating the BRIC moniker more than a decade ago, he also has been one of the most respected economists and global strategists. So I thought it would be interesting to look at the kinds of things that he looks at for, I think, as a barometer for the health of the global economy. Well, one of those is South Korea. The Korean market is the 11th largest economy in the world, and because the top 10 are those that are put together when people start to think about synchronized global economic expansion, South Korea often tends to get left out because it's the 11th largest economy, but at the same time, it is home to companies like Samsung and all of its ancillary businesses, and Kia and Hyundai and SK Corp and LG. So there is no exaggeration in saying that it is not only a major contributor to the global economy, but that it is also a barometer for global demand growth, considering its massive export sector for the semiconductor, the consumer electronics, and the automotive sectors. And the KOSPI has encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean. The Korean economy contracted in the first quarter, so that certainly is not such great news. And it's going to have to at least sustain a move back above the 2200 point level in order to begin to suggest that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, if we then go on and look at some of the other barometers that he's looking at, well, one of them is manufacturing activity. The PMI index in the USA has been ranging between about 40 and 60 for more than 30 years. It got right up to 60 back in 2018. It has contracted, certainly in 2019, but at least stabilized. But it would be, I think the most expected outcome would be that it goes back down towards 50. That's what it's done every other time that it has got back up towards 60. So on this occasion, the most, I think, consistent expectation we might have is that it would contract somewhat further. Now, if we continue along with this group, it's also worth considering that U.S. unemployment is at close to record lows. It hasn't been this low since 1969. And this also brings to light some of the features that I've commented on at Comment of the Day today, that the USA, and most particularly the Federal Reserve, the government, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, what they're trying to do now is to reevaluate how they not only gather data, but compile it and then report it. So back at the beginning of October, excuse me, back at the beginning of April, what they said was that they are going to look for additional sources of information on the apparel market, and that was expected to shave about 0.05% off of the inflation measure. But that's only one segment of the information gathering procedure that over the course of the next couple of years, they expect to take approximately 35% of all the data that they're using to compile the inflation measure from these alternative sources. And that is, it's, well, if we look at history, it's quite unlikely that they're going to choose a potential outcome that is going to result in higher inflation. In other words, they have a history of picking measures that are going to contribute to lower inflation gauges. At the same time, they are beginning to now consider how they report the inflation measure, and they are talking about moving from an absolute recent, most recent figure to an average. And what we have seen is that the average hasn't gone above 2% since 2009. What all of this points towards is the Federal Reserve setting the stage for the next round of quantitative easing or monetary stimulus. They're not doing it yet, but they're certainly setting the stage for the rationale that will be used to justify that kind of decision. That should be considered rather bullish, because markets already have concluded that they have a Powell put, but we haven't yet seen interest rate cuts. We haven't yet seen an expansion of the central bank's balance sheet. What we have seen are commitments not to raise interest rates and to taper the reduction in the size of the balance sheet, but not much more than that. I think that's part of the reason why there is still this reticence about concluding that we are clearly in a bull market environment. But when we look at unemployment figures, well, they did pop on the upside at the beginning of this year, and they are coming back down. Well, the last time we got back to this level was in early 2000, and, well, we know what happened subsequent to that. So now we can think that the most recent lower rally high is around 4%, and a sustained move above that level would really start to question the integrity of the more than decade-long decline. And that's, I think, one of the easiest trends to monitor. Now, moving along, we should also look at Chinese electricity consumption. It has been trending higher in a relatively persistent manner for more than a decade, and it has popped on the upside again since the beginning of this year. This chart was most recently updated at the end of March, so we don't know exactly what it's doing yet in April, but this does look like a reasonably consistent advance, finding support at the beginning of every year following a contraction at the end of the calendar year on just about every year since 2009. Well, as long as that sequence of higher reaction lows remains intact, then I think we can conclude that the Chinese market is still in a reasonably firm footing. Then I think we should also start to think about Wall Street, because the stock market is a lead indicator. And when we start to think about the S&P 500, well, it is right in the region of its all-time peak. We have seen two occasions in the last 12 months where it has tested this region. Well, the market was up another 13 points in here today. It's taken it within a single point of the all-time peak at the close. When we look at the trend over the course of the last decade, well, we can see that there have been two previous periods of rather intense volatility. What I think is also worth considering is that we should be looking at it on a logarithmic scale, for the simple reason that the vast majority of investors are unleveraged cash on a cash basis. And when we look at it on that those terms, then this pullback we've seen in 2018 was somewhat larger than the pullback we saw in 2015 and 16, and very much on a par with what we saw in 2011. We've had a rollicking advance this year so far, and that continues to be in play. The simple fact of the matter is that we are continuing to see indications that the global economy is beginning to slow down, or perhaps not simply beginning, but has been slowing down over the course of the last 6 months. What we've also seen is that central banks are beginning to move into action. When, for example, we look at UPS, there is a preponderance of downward dynamics over the course of the last 16 months. And the most recent of those was this week. It came in on pretty weak earnings. And there is a clear conclusion there that the global economy must be slowing down if UPS is performing like this. But there is the additional point that Amazon is doing a lot more of its own, of delivering its own produce. And when we look at Amazon, it beat its earnings estimates in here this week, but there are significant plans underway to speed up delivery times. So the first would be from, we're currently on 2 days, two-day delivery. They're looking at introducing one-day delivery. They're going to spend about $800 million on that initiative, and that's a substantial sum of money. But the market is more than willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside, and it was up an additional $48 in here today. This is bringing Amazon back within sight of the $2,000 level. The strategy that has worked best with Amazon over the course of the last decade has been to buy the dips. And again, here I think it is worth looking at the market on a log scale basis. Because when we think about it on a log scale, then the pullback that we saw in the latter quarter of last year was certainly larger than any other we've seen in the course of the bull market, but not all that much larger. It was approximately 35%. It's not unusual for Amazon to have pulled back by 30% in the course of this bull market. And this is against a background where the share has rallied from approximately $60 to $2,000. So it has been the clear outperformer in this bull market, and it continues to do so. More than any other share in the world, I consider this to be a clear barometer for the health of the consumer in the USA. And it has rallied significantly this year so far. In fact, only four shares represent more than 50% of the advance on the NASDAQ. Obviously, Amazon is one of those. What we are certainly seeing is that when we start to look at everything that we've considered so far, we look at the kind of barometers that a noted economist like Jim O'Neill is looking at, and we can conclude that there is evidence that the economy slowed down last year, not just in the USA, but everywhere else. So that's one potential conclusion. Then we can look at the actions that central banks have engaged in since then. So the Federal Reserve has said that they're going to stop raising interest rates. They're going to pause, or they're at least going to taper the pace with which they're reducing the size of their balance sheet. The ECB has announced another LTRO program, and they look quite likely to potentially move back into a quantitative easing situation if the European economy contracts further. And China has very clearly said they do not want to engage in quantitative easing again, and they've spent the last 3 years trying to stamp out the splurge in lending activity that the shadow banking sector has engaged in. That transition is now complete, and they are engaging in fiscal stimulus rather than monetary stimulus. So we are starting to see that central banks are providing the necessary liquidity infusions to sustain this bull market. When we think about the NASDAQ, well, it broke out in pretty emphatic fashion to new all-time highs in here this week. And that's a rollicking improvement on the rather mundane, or I think the size of the pullback that we saw at the end of last year. Rallying from 6,000 to 8,000 is a really very impressive advance. There is a short-term overbought condition, and that does hold out the prospect of some consolidation. But as long as the price continues to advance, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Well, obviously, Amazon doing as well as it is contributing to this really quite impressive advance. What I think is really quite interesting is that of the shares that are contributing to this breakout to all-time new highs by the NASDAQ 100, only one of them is actually itself at new highs. Apple, for example, had pulled back really very violently over the course of the period from the peak at the end of the third quarter last year down to the low around 150. It wasn't quite able to hold on to all of its gain in here this week. And I do think that we are likely to get some additional consolidation in Apple, not least because if we look at the other periods of consolidation that we've seen, particularly between 2012 and 2014, and again between 2015 and 2016, then these periods of consolidation have tended to last quite long. And we've really only been in this corrective phase for the last 7 months. So I think of the four leaders in this advance since Boxing Day, Apple is the one that is most likely to experience further consolidation. Then we have Facebook, and Facebook had pulled back extraordinarily violently in the summer of last year when they voluntarily decided they were going to try and police their online forum. Well, I think it is arguable whether that is in fact really achievable, but we've had a very impressive move in here this week, and it wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance into the close on Friday, but so far this has been a really impressive advance off the lows on Boxing Day, and it remains a recovery candidate. Well, then Microsoft is the only one of those shares that has been able to sustain a move up and out to new recovery highs. And the share was up in an emphatic manner on strong earnings in here this week. Well, the pace of this advance is picking up. Microsoft has adopted a subscription model in its own right for its Windows service. In addition to that, it is rolling out cloud-based software for the corporate sector, but also for consumers, and most particularly in the gaming sector. And together, the adoption of a subscription business model and its movement into the cloud computing sector are both being used as a rationale for continuing to support the share. Well, then, of course, you have the very clear point that Microsoft is a company that has been paying a rather attractive dividend over the course of the last decade, that when they initiated the dividend back in 2009, I'm just going to check to make sure that that is, in fact, when it was initiated, and they have been growing that dividend persistently since then. Well, the speed with which the price is going up is contracting the yield down to about 1.35%, but it's a very persistent advance. This is one of the most important points, I think, is that a substantial number of the technology companies have got such attractive margins that they are now in a position to not only pay dividends but increase those dividends at an accelerating clip. And that is something that I think investors are beginning to pay attention to, because we're seeing an increasing number of retirees moving towards the technology sector. But the broader picture is that it is another arrow in their quiver, that when we start to think about the rationale for supporting these high momentum shares, it isn't simply that they have a good product or a good business model, but that they have attractive margins, they have the momentum on their side, and they have the kinds of characteristics that make them appealing to pension investors. And that's perhaps one of the most important points. Cisco Systems is another example of that. They've also adopted a subscription business model, and when we look at the share, then it was in negative territory in here today. I think this is the beginning of some pause and consolidation, not least because the share has gone from 40 to 55 over the course of the last 10 weeks, and there is at least some rationale for a pause and consolidation. Qualcomm, over the course of the last few, let's first look at the dividends on Cisco Systems. It's been rallying impressively, and yet it still yields about 2.4%, and they've been increasing that dividend on a reliable basis for years. Then Qualcomm is in a very similar situation. They have been also increasing their dividend for a really impressive period of time, and at least a decade. It is currently yielding 2.86%, having won or at least gained a very favorable judgment from the acrimonious legal dispute with Apple. The share has done nothing but rise over the course of the last 2 weeks, and yet the share still yields 2.86%. When we look at it on a weekly basis, the fact of the matter is that Qualcomm has been ranging below $80 for the last 5 years and is really only now breaking on the upside. Well, that, I think, highlights that investors are willing to look at the technology sector not only from a growth perspective but from a dividend perspective. Then when we look at some of the key constituents of the Dow Jones, which are considered to be the blue chips, then Walt Disney has broken out in a very emphatic fashion following the close of business or the close of its merger with 20th Century Fox, and this has been a clear breakout from what was effectively a more than 4 year range. So that's a really impressive advance. What it also suggests is that despite the fact that we have companies like Triple M pulling back in an extraordinarily volatile manner, there are pockets of clear outperformance. The fact that Disney is now entering the subscription model with the release of Disney Plus, the fact that it is acquiring, or at least in the process of acquiring, all of the Hulu service, that is holding out the prospect that it is going to adopt more of a subscription business model for the entire spectrum of its very large intellectual property and brand portfolio. That kind of transition in the business model is rather difficult to promote for industrial companies like 3M, and it has pulled back in a very violent manner in here this week. Well, what this, I think, is really, if we start then go back and start to look again at the other points that we were looking at the beginning of this broadcast, we can clearly see that there are very clear pockets of outperformance, and they are very much concentrated in the cloud computing and subscription business model environments. There is also another way of thinking about that is that there is a narrowing of the breadth in this market. If we think about it from the perspective of an investment manager or fund manager who has got a benchmark like the S&P 500 and is aiming to try and outperform it, well, what choice do they have but to concentrate their portfolio in the best performers, the momentum leaders, such as Amazon, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, or in the hands of companies that have adopted or are in the process of adopting the subscription business model, because these are the sectors that are clearly outperforming in this environment. They have benefited both from the availability of credit and also the continued transition that we're seeing from an over-the-counter market to an online marketplace. That's particularly true of the subscription business model, because it's very hard to have a subscription business model if you don't have the internet. Certainly, it's possible to have direct debit mandates, but they have to be constantly updated. And if you have an internet-based business, then a subscription business model is much easier to roll out. What's, I think, rather interesting is Zuora is a company that is providing the name of the company correctly. So what This is, I think I probably wrote it correctly the first time. Yep. Zora is a company that is providing the subscription software to companies. And that is riding on the back of the continued demand for subscription business models from an increasingly large number of companies. And companies like this kind of business model because it tends to streamline their cash flows. Analysts like the subscription business model because it makes companies a lot easier to analyze, and it makes them almost uniquely favorable in terms of the dividend discount model. But what it is in fact doing is taking highly cyclical technology companies and turning their cash flows into something that approximates the consistency and reliability of consumer staples. And that transition is, I think, largely unappreciated by the vast majority of investors, because what we're starting to see is that technology shares that are really considered to be high growth are being priced like consumer staples. And what's, I think, particularly worth considering is that consumer staples companies themselves had led on the upside in terms of the beginning of this bull market, and certainly went through a rather lengthy hiatus over the course of the last nearly 3 years, but it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of its range. And there is a clear potential that it is going to break on the upside, but the PE for this sector is close to 20. Well, if we look at, for example, the S&P 500 information technology sector, then when we look at the valuation for that, it's at 21. So one of the things that I've heard many value-oriented investors comment on, it was something that they have considered that it was impossible to invest in consumer staples because they are at rocket high valuations, whereas that valuation is actually lower than the information technology sector. Information technology is generally afforded a higher valuation because of the growth multiple. But when you see that information technology is also adopting the same kind of reliability in terms of their cash flows that consumer staples are approximating today, then perhaps they should be afforded an even higher multiple. That, I think, is what is contributing to their outperformance. And we can see that the information technology sector has pushed on to new high ground. That's very much reflecting the breakout we've seen in the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index. But what we did see this week was at least some pause and consolidation beginning, and it wasn't quite able to hold the peak when it got up to the 1600 point level. So this does look like at least another range similar to the one put in at the end of March and again at the beginning of March. Those were both in the order of approximately 100 point pullbacks, and so far that is exactly what the index has done on this occasion. So we are getting at least some pause in consolidation. As long as it's holding the 1500 point level, then that's all that it is likely to do. We are at a point today in markets where there is a clear potential that we are entering the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, and arguably we're already in it. Central banks are at the point where they have tightened somewhat, but they don't want to tighten further lest they create a recession. And that is a license for investors to engage in more risky activity. That's exactly the kind of scenario that creates bubbles. And I think that it is quite likely that, considering that the introduction of quantitative easing was done in a panicky environment where everyone is considering that we were going to have a recession, not just a recession, but a depression. And now that visceral experience is what central bankers are still worried about, so they are willing to risk the inflation of another bubble rather than to, I think, weigh on the economic expansion and risk that they would be the cause of a recession. Well, that suggests that we are in the third psychological perception stage. This is exactly the period where monetary policy has begun to tighten, but it is not so tight that it represents a headwind. We are at a pause in the pace of monetary tightening, and the economies of the world are starting to turn back to performance. Arguably, when you look at the performance of economic indicators, the Chinese economy has slowed down, so they are engaged in fiscal stimulus. The Chinese or the Japanese economy probably contracted in the first quarter. That holds out the prospect of additional stimulus. What we're starting to see in Europe is that the German economy is under rather severe strain. And part of the reason for that is because of the domestic environment. But then, of course, you have the twin headwinds of both demand for cars in China, which has been contracting as a result of the rules on car ownership that have been rolled out to an increasingly large number of cities, on top of the fact that there is increasing demand, not least as a result of regulation for electric vehicles. Well, the DAX index remains in strong territory, but part of the reason for that is because the euro is continuing to contract. And when we zoom in and look at that on a weekly basis, and sorry, it has not given me the euro. Well, when we look at the euro, it is now below 112, but it was in positive territory in here today. What we have seen over the course of the last few months is that it has paused at 116, 115, 114, 113, and again now at 112, and failed at 112 and came right down to test the 111 area. Well, it's, I think, quite likely that we are going to see it rally back up to test the 112 area, but then the big question is what happens from then? Because Europe needs a weaker currency. And they are already engaged in another lending program to ameliorate the pressure that comes to bear on the banking sector as a result of negative interest rates. That's referred to as the LTRO program. And I think it is quite likely they're going to engage in additional monetary stimulus in the event that the economy does not respond to the continued downward pressure being put on yields. And then we have the USA, where we have got evidence over the course of the last few months that we do have a Powell put. Well, what this is suggesting is that we do have now got the conditions that can create bubbly activity, because central banks have begun to walk away from their ambition to tighten monetary and conditions any further. And that's, I think, the most important point. So when we look at the subscription business model and the cloud computing sectors and the mega cap large large cap growth sectors, that is where we're likely to see the first evidence of bubbly activity. If we do get a reflation trade, well, I think it is quite likely that we're going to start to see a recovery in the mining sector. Well, the FTSE 350 mining index had pulled back really quite sharply yesterday, and it was in additional negative territory in here today. It's going to have to hold the region of the trend mean if this is going to remain a reasonably benign environment. But this is looking increasingly like a failed upside break. And copper prices were in positive territory in here today, and they are or at least they continue to look like they're putting in a first step above the six-month base formation, and at least firming from the region of the trend mean in here this week. The London Metals Index had pulled back below the trend mean yesterday, but with the bounce in copper in here today, and this will not be updated until well after the close in here today, there is the potential that it is going to find support in this area. Well, that would certainly help to, I think, confirm that there is some credence to the view that we are on the cusp of a global reflation trade. The ASX 300 Resources Index has also paused. Well, the relative weakness of the Australian dollar should act as a tailwind to performance for the mining sector, considering that they are selling their products in US dollars, but the Aussie dollar has so far held the 70 cent level. But it was down in a rather dynamic manner in here this week. So it's going to have to do more than simply pause. It's going to have to bounce in an emphatic manner in order to really confirm support in this area. If resources do pick up, well, then I think we can give at least we can have some hope that the Aussie dollar is going to bounce in here, but not perhaps until we see that event. I think it's worth highlighting that the Bloomberg Dollar Index is much less weighted by the euro than the traditional dollar index, and it has not yet broken out to new recovery highs, but it certainly was firm in here today, when we look at the dollar index, it is at a new recovery high, and that's because of the euro. Of course, there are other currencies against which the dollar is measured, and the renminbi is perhaps the most important one of those. Well, the renminbi had weakened in the early part of this week, but Xi Jinping came out in here today and said that he didn't want to use the renminbi as a weapon, so the renminbi strengthened up again from the region of the trend mean. The fact that we've had a meaningful rebound in the performance of the A-share market in Shanghai this year is representative of the potential for at least a reflation trade in China. But it was pulling back in a violent manner this week, and that is suggestive of at least some pause of consolidation. This is now the largest pullback we've seen since at least December. So the trend has now lost consistency, and it is pulling back into the underlying trading range. So there is obviously a need now for a clear upward dynamic in order to confirm a return to demand dominance. And at the moment, at least, it looks like we are in a reversionary process back towards the trend mean. China has demonstrated that they are willing to engage in fiscal stimulus. The market is probably looking for more than that. And it was China's willingness to engage in massive stimulative measures back in 2008 and 2009 that rescued the global economy. And so far, they have been unwilling to engage in that kind of activity. But what we also saw in here this week was that Xi Jinping is more amenable to the kinds of demands that the Trump administration have been making in the trade war. What I do think is that a lot of the good news from the trade war has probably already been priced in, and that when we do get a favorable announcement to that event, then we're likely to see some pause and consolidation take hold. That will probably be the catalytic event to really spur central banks into action. Then I think when we start to think about the longer term, I know that I've spent the majority of this broadcast so far talking about the kinds of factors that are important right away, or at least over the short to medium term. Oil prices today were down by $2.73, and that's a meaningful move. That is an inconsistency. It is the biggest pullback we've seen since December. And It is confirming resistance in the region of the $75 area. It is coming back down into the most recent one of these little ranges. What is particularly interesting is that this trend did lose consistency at the penultimate high. The size of the range put in the middle of April was considerably smaller than the one put in between March or February and March. And now we've had a much larger pullback. This suggests that we have a peak of at least near-term significance for the oil price. And that is, I think, going to be confirmed if we see a move through $70 on Monday. So it is now more important to monitor the oil price than at any time over the course of the last 4 months. There is a lot of additional supply becomes economic around the $75 area. Well, one thing that I think is also particularly interesting is that gold prices have been reasonably steady around the $1,275 area, and that coincides with the region of the trend mean. And they were up by about $10 in here today. Well, this is at least confirming near-term support around the region of the trend mean. If it can sustain a move back above $1,300, well, then it will be breaking the sequence of lower rally highs from the peak back in February, and that can be construed as being really quite bullish. The fact is that if central banks are moving towards not only additional sources of liquidity, but also tinkering with the way that they report inflation, that holds out the prospect that we're going to have negative real interest rates. And it is negative real interest rates which are the clearest rationale for owning an asset like gold that cannot simply be lent into existence. That is equally true of Bitcoin. Well, Bitcoin is a very different animal to gold, and not least because you can't hold it in your hand. The price rallied really quite impressively in the early part of this month, but it has pulled back in a dynamic manner over the course of the last 2 days. The way that I would consider, just 1 day, but the way that I would consider the crash that transpired in the Bitcoin market over the course of the last 18 months was very much akin to what happened in terms of the stock market in 1987. All the way through until about September of 2017, this was a cash-settled market. Then people really started to buy aggressively in advance of the introduction of futures. And what in effect happened was that more people used the futures as hedges against their long positions than for speculative long positioning. And that created a synthetic short which crashed the market, which is almost exactly what happened with the introduction of index futures in 1987, when everyone decided that they wanted to hedge their long exposure by going short. It created a big synthetic short position which crashed the market. Well, the futures market has now been closed, or is in the process of closing, for Bitcoin, whereas major players like JP Morgan and Fidelity are moving into the sector and looking at how to provide custody services. This is a massive transition for the market, because one of the most, the biggest headwinds to institutional participation in the cryptocurrency market has been custody. If Fidelity, for example, can solve the custody problem, then that will be a green light for institutional investors to take positions. That's why this is looking increasingly like a first step above the base. As long as this range persists above the range, then I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to recovery scenario. And the fact that gold is bouncing from the region of the trend mean in tandem with the return to performance of cryptocurrencies is representative of investors starting to look at some form of hedge against the potential for central banks to abuse their respective currencies. And I do think that is perhaps the most likely scenario. Well, when we think about the outlook for the global economy and the long term, well, there is no change that we're definitely seeing an uptick in the pace of innovation, the continued advance of technology. The pace of technological innovation is accelerating at an exponential rate. The introduction of an artificial intelligence has accelerated the pace of innovation in an increasingly large number of sectors. That's a very meaningful transition. There is a real possibility that we are going to get autonomous vehicles. That alone is enough of a change to the global economy that could create a secular bull market in its own right. It would also be something that would be transformational for companies like Google and Tesla. Google is back above the $1,200 area, and it was at a new closing high in here this week. This is a company that generates the majority of its money from advertising, and the outlook for the domestic or the autonomous vehicle market is not really in the price at all. Well, that suggests that there is potential for additional upside for this share if it can sustain a move up and above this 1200 point level. What this also helps to really ram home is that there are clear arguments for the continued outperformance of technology shares, and that they are not only creating new markets, but that they are stealing market share from the regular industrial sector. And I think that's one of the most important points, that we're getting a narrowing of breadth in this market, that it is not simply that this is not a regular cycle, that it is being driven by new companies that are developing new shares. This is much more a reflection of the kind of market we had in the late 1990s than what we had in 2006 and 2007. The fact that we are now getting a lot more IPOs is also something that needs to be considered. That we are at a point today where there is a lot of additional supply coming into the market. Lyft has pulled back significantly from its IPO price. It did steady in here today, and it is at least steadying around the $55 area over the course of the last few weeks. But this is all in anticipation of the major IPO for Uber, which is looking at a valuation of approximately $88 billion. And that is a very significant sum for a company that has never made a profit. Well, I know that if I were a short seller with a cynical attitude, I would probably short Lyft in an attempt to ensure that the price demanded by Uber investors was somewhat lower so that I could try and buy it at a more attractive price. Well, that's, I think, if I'm correct in that's in surmising that, then there is the potential that Uber's IPO will be successful, and that it will not fall 30-40% just a day after trading begins. We will definitely see how that goes, because the IPO is going to be in the next couple of weeks. Then I think it's also worth highlighting that the yield curve spread did not go negative, and that the traditional 2 and 10 year spread has in fact widened and is back above the 21 basis point level. Unemployment is still at close to record lows. The stock market is pushing on to new high ground. The dollar is really quite firm. These are all pretty bullish factors. What it suggests is that we are quite likely to be entering the third psychological perception stage of this bull market, which is often characterized by mania or acceleration. The narrowing of breadth in the market is also supportive of that conclusion. So there is the potential now that with markets starting to push on the upside, despite the fact that in the short term there is some I think risk of pause and consolidation. We may even have started to see the beginning of that in here this week, that the medium-term outlook continues to look reasonably bullish. Eventually, this move will climax, but we are not there yet. And that is, I think, when we think about if this is the third psychological perception stage, then it is the time to become most alert to losses of uptrend consistency. We definitely had a big loss of consistency last year, and there have been significant efforts to try and repair that. As long as those remain intact, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When central banks do eventually begin to tighten once more, valuations are likely to be significantly higher than they are today, and that will also be a factor in what will probably result in a larger pullback than we saw in the fourth quarter of last year. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.